Welcome to another segment of the Grassy Knoll. This is February 8th, 2007. And we're going to have on the I-Man for the second of a two-parter that began Tuesday, and with Alan Watt in the middle. We will be talking about the War Powers Act, and then we start, I guess, in the last 15 minutes or so, hitting a couple other topics. I-Man was in good form because he had been down for quite some time with an illness, and never really heard on that that ebullion, if you will. So I made the most of it while we could. We did it an hour and a half, all told. All right, now, not realizing that I didn't update the upcoming shows, just to let you know, tomorrow, Friday, February 9th, Bob Chapman's back for his monthly visit. And then we're going to have, let's see, starting on the 12th, Jay Beldo will be back, talking about the CIA and I guess its impact on the counterculture or the culture of the times, especially as it relates to the 60s. And we're going to have Aunt Harriet. That's it. That's Harriet. She is a childhood friend of Andrew Colvin, who did the Mothman series, and she's going to come on and talk about some of the experiences she's had. Also, you may have mentioned, you may remember Andy having mentioned Harriet during a number of the shows. Also, we're going to have Vets for 9/11 Truth on the 14th, Alphonse, who's been with us twice before. On the 15th, we're going to have on Nico Haupt. On the 16th, we're going to have Neil from the UK, and we'll talk more about that as we get into next week. Also, on the 19th and the 20th, we're going to have on Dave McGowan to talk about his most notable book on one day, and then we're going to talk about Flight 93 on another. We haven't figured out which is going to be which first, but that's coming up on the 19th and the 20th. On the 21st, we're going to have Kent Benkowski from the Kentroversy Papers. On the 22nd, I haven't firmed it up, but that's usually when Utikins for 9/11 Truth come on. And on 23, I'm trying to get Angie from Think or Be Eaten website. Also on the 26th, Monday, it's tentatively planned to have Eric John Phelps debate a Muslim gentleman from the state of New Jersey, no doubt. And that's where we stand as far as what is going on for the almost for the remainder of the month. And I'll get that upcoming shows brought up to speed as we've read them here. Also, you may have heard me refer to the Black Racer, R-A-I, excuse me, S-E-R, Black Razor, R-A-I-S-E-R.com website. I refer to it because of the information they have there about the Nazi Masonic link. So you might be interested in knowing that Peter, who's the force behind that website, is in fact coming on, we hope, the 27th, the 28th. And that's the way that it rounds out for the most part for the month of February. All right, now we'll be joining I-Man in a second, and I'll see you after the interview.
Coming up next from the Grassy Knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately control over you. You.
Also, at this time too, you've mentioned a lot of sites and such, and I mean sites with a C-I-T-E-S. Uh-huh. But let's talk about your site, S-I-G-H-T. No, that would be S-I-T-E. Sorry, don't want to confuse. Yeah, don't want to talk too long. All right, but your website under atgpress.com, right. You have a section as well as, and James still has one too, doesn't he?
Yeah.
All right, now they can go there and just search for The Informer.
Yeah, and then there's three particular ones in there. The question is why. That's one of them. There's one there that says war powers.
Oh yeah, that's I'm there now. Right.
War powers in America today.
Right.
The question is why, and what's the other one there? I can't remember what it is.
Well, what I'm looking at actually was where you have a table, if you will, with banking, government, common sense, taxes,
uh-huh.
Foreign America, Social Security, books by the Informer, phone tax, war powers, and admiralty.
Okay, yeah, it's up in the very top. It should say war powers, I think.
Oh, it does. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then you click on that, and it'll take you down the...
The three of them that's in there.
Right.
War powers in America today.
Right.
The question is why. And that will give you a running history from way back when, in 1792, when Washington first started it, all the way up to present day.
All right. So, folks, by all means, please check that out. Is there anything else you want to tell folks about your section of that website?
No, the only thing that I haven't put anything on there is, have you seen the email about the Armand Kondo, the letter that was written by Judge Mercier?
No.
Okay. That just came out again. Now, 1985, Armand Kondo had a group, and he wrote a letter to Mercier, who was... supposedly a retired judge, but I think he was a clerk, a federal clerk, and he had some good stuff. And I saw it back then, and it was another guy called Frank May, who I know personally, who wanted to get a little better insight and wrote to Mercier and asked him, gee, the letter you sent to Kondo was good, but I need a little more information. Well, I understand that he wrote him a 747-page letter. Okay? Ooh. About a whole bunch of stuff. And the one thing in there that they had was... what makes you a taxpayer? You know, because he had all these latches and these contracts that are invisible contracts and everything that you have. And in there, he says that one of the invisible contracts that makes you a taxpayer is your bank signature card. Well, this goes back in '85, and, you know, I looked at it. I stuck in the back of my mind, didn't think much about it. Another fellow, a friend of mine, he does pretty good. And, you know, we just, one of those things, you know, that it just crops up and you don't pay too much attention to it. Well, in the later years of doing all the research and finding out how the Federal Reserve note is the main reason of the taxation, because it's private script, has a lien on it already issued by the Federal Reserve, so they own it. You only have the use of it. And their situs is in Washington, D.C., naturally, because that's where the Federal Reserve is located. And he says that when you sign your bank signature card, you agree to, and I have seen this, you're supposed to get a 454-page contract. When you sign a signature card, this is not a signature card. That is a contract whereby, if you read on the back of the signature card, it says you abide by all the rules of the bank. Well, wait a minute. All the banks are private, right? They're all owned by the Federal Reserve.
Exactly.
Well,
most
controlled by the Federal Reserve. They're all separately there. There are state banks or federal banks, but they all get their directives from who?
The Bank of England.
Well, they're front guy down here in the...
Oh, okay, yeah. Or whoever is the...
Secretary of Treasury.
Oh, okay. I was going to say the head of the Fed. All right.
No. Well, the Secretary of Treasury just so happens to be the governor of the International Monetary Fund.
Oh, Wolfowitz? Who is it now?
I don't know. Some idiot. I can't remember his name.
Who, the Secretary of the Treasury?
Secretary of the Treasury.
All right, okay.
He's the Secretary of the Treasury, but not of the United States. He's the Secretary of the Treasury of the Federal Reserve.
All right.
And he's also the governor of the International Monetary Fund.
Okay.
And the World Bank. And the Attorney General is the second alternate. So Gonzalez is the second alternate, and that's why neither one of them can subscribe an oath of office under Title 5 U.S.C., 3331. They can't, because the minute they sign, they're in treason. Because they stand up and take an oral oath, but they don't subscribe the oath, because they're not officially United States citizens, because they are operating for a foreign concern.
Okay, now, and the foreign concern now, would be...
The foreign concern would be the Bank of England.
Bank of England, okay, right.
Yeah, because the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England is one and the same. Now, so Mercier said, when you sign that signature card, then you agree to the bankruptcy, you agree to pay all debts, you agree to 7203 of Title 26, you agree to all of Title 26. That's your contract that makes you a taxpayer. No matter what you argue, it can't be a constitutional issue because it's a private contract, and private contracts take precedent over any constitutional issue. And that's why the judges said, don't bring the Constitution in here. It don't apply. You got a private contract. But they don't tell you you got a private contract. And everybody wonders, where is this private contract? Well, it's your signature card.
So when somebody goes in and says, I'd just like to open a checking account?
That's right.
They're already...
Savings, whatever. It doesn't matter. And the reason why I found this out is when the Bobby Carey case in 1995, when he sued the IRS, the International Monetary Fund, the governor, and all those, in like you should, we had 3 days in a building where we could not take the 454-page contract out of their site. So John Nelson and me and about five other researchers were there, because I was an expert witness.
Mm-hmm.
We had 3 days to look at it. Now, you can't digest 454 pages of all this fine legalese in 3 days. I don't care how many people, we was all looking at it. We have one book. And how many people can you get around? You got three people looking over
right.
each other's shoulder, you know?
Right.
But in there, oh, man, I mean, you know, you give your life away.
Well,
but now, Mercier said that this is how they do it. But I'm thinking just the other day, when I got it again and looked at it, that, hey, wait a minute. UCC is involved. It's private international law. It's private contract. Therefore, it's fraud on the factum because they never gave you
the contract.
Right. To begin with,
mm-hmm.
and under UCC, with the acceptance going into Title Section 9 of the UCC, you got to read all that, and then go into your contract acceptance in Chapter 3, and you'll see how you can get out of it. But once you know, and you go in, you can't get out of it, because you are forewarned.
Well, what do you mean by once you know? In other words, if you have this information and then you sign...
If you have this information, you can't fall back on it and say, I didn't know. They didn't tell me. Well, wait a minute. You knew. But this is only for people that don't know.
Well, okay, so now I say I know.
Well, you really don't. You just heard it from me.
Right.
You don't have an authoritative source where you know from.
Well, how would you demonstrate?
Well, that's right. There you go. There's the fraud. See how they got you?
Well, how would they? How would one demonstrate a previous knowledge?
You ask them under FOIA. What is the basis of authority that you have on a contract that I might have signed that brought me into your fold? Sort of, you know, in a roundabout way. You can phrase it any way you want.
Right.
But that is how you have to do it. And I don't know if you'll ever get an answer. I've never tried it. I didn't have to. When I did my complaint, I went right to the source. And, you know, I got non-taxpayer status and yada, yada, yada since 1998. I don't have to worry about it.
You don't pay IRS?
No.
So what do you think about that Ed Brown situation?
He doesn't know. He's out in left field somewhere.
This is really misguided, isn't it?
Yeah, totally misguided.
And it's going to only come to ruination? Probably.
Oh, yeah. He's going down the tube. See, anytime anybody goes into court, anytime, consider yourself cooked. You're done. You lost. The minute you step in the court, you lost. All it is how much money are you going to give us? How many times? How many years you want to spend in jail? I just had a friend. I'm not going to name names or anybody or where he's at, but he and I was conversing, and he said that he was getting something for me for my race car, and he told me, he says, you know, he said, give me a week, I got to go somewhere, and yada, 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 and I, okay, all right. And then he says, the wolves are hounding at my door, so I called him, no answer, no emails, the emails kept kicking back, his cell phone didn't answer. I finally found out from someone in California who had Pacer that this guy was arrested and put in jail for failure to appear on a summons in court. And he went to court and he said, from what I understand now, he had made arrangements with the IRS to go to court to settle this on a compromise, an offer and compromise. Well, guess what? He went to court. It was later. He had worked it all out, went to court, just like you see on TV. Oh, we'll help you out. We'll do this. We'll do this. And then they get you in court and you're cooked. You know? Well, that's what happened. He thought he was going in, getting this all straightened out, all nice. And it just happened last week, Monday, Tuesday.
Right.
And he's now sitting in jail because whatever charges he's got, he did not appear, argue the case correctly. He just refused to go and argued it on paper.
So they suckered him to come in?
Yeah. And that's what they do with everybody.
All right, if he didn't go in, what would have happened?
They would have sent the marshals out and arrested him anyway.
Oh, they would have, okay.
Yeah.
Also, because of... is it because of the War Powers Act also that we've existed under Admiralty law and courts?
Oh, we always have, because the Constitution was set up under Admiralty. If you go and pull it up and you read the 1789 First Judiciary Act, the whole thing was set up. And if you read Benedict on Admiralty in Matthew P. Bender's books, like the 7th edition, if you can get back to the first edition, which nobody can get, but I do have a copy, it makes it so clear that a grade school, now I'm talking 8th, 9th, 10th grade school person, woman, kid, could pick it up and read it and understand it. The first book, the very first time.
All right, so they didn't put all the legalese and stuff in there, huh?
No, but it was old-time stuff, and now the new books, even the 7th, when I got full complete 26 volume of the 7th, and you go through that and read it, man, I mean, it tells you right in the very beginning in Benedict in the first two volumes, that's all you have to read is the first two volumes. The rest is like wallpaper of the other 24 volumes. They're all good. I mean, they all have something in it. But the first two volumes goes through the whole entire history of the Admiralty and how this Constitution in the United States was formed under Admiralty principles. Now, you got to remember this. Weren't we a bunch of colonies? Weren't we in international law? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We were international colonies who turned into international states, still operating under maritime law. Because everything operated through ports.
All right.
All the products from this country going and shipped out operated through maritime principles.
All right, so you're saying that from the time we were colonies,
yes,
through the time we were states,
mm-hmm,
there was only one method of conveyance, and that was obviously what we would call surface shipping by water.
Right.
And that's why Admiralty ruled.
Yep. And that's why in 1857, the United States was the only country that they brought Admiralty inland so that they could use the produce of the farmers under international maritime law.
And just to be, I mean, this is another whole 9 yards, but...
Even when you go through insurance, title insurance on your house is maritime law, and that's how the states can operate and control your so-called property, because they are listed as a beneficiary on title insurance. There's a man in North Carolina here that found this out and is in the process of trying, and he already did, stripped himself and told them he wanted no more title insurance because because the lawyer did it, but the lawyer wrote it up and did not include the state as the beneficiary, which it is, and he left that in there, and this is what he's fighting for the past 4 years on it. And if you eliminate the title insurance and eliminate the beneficiaries, they have no beneficial interest in that property. Therefore, how can they tax you?
So not only is this a scam for being able to tax, but also we are looking at a situation where I guess you could say we never and certainly don't have now any allodial title.
There's never been an allodial title in the United States,
right,
ever.
Okay.
The only allodial title, and it wasn't even allodial, was to the seven proprietors. The seven proprietors owned all the land under Grant of the King and Lord Granville, where I live in Granville County. That's why it's called Granville County.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only holdout when the king wanted his land back before the 1783 treaty.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, it's not enough just to research, but you've got to see what was piled on top of a pile on top of a pile on top. And when you put it all together, it makes a homogeneous mix. You don't have a lemon meringue pie where the lemon's on the bottom and meringue's up top. You've got a whole mix, but it looks like the lemon meringue is separated, right?
Right.
Well, in Admiralty and Maritime and all these machinations that are going on through insurance and stuff like that, which is all insurance. I don't care whether it's house insurance, car insurance, life insurance, any kind of insurance you've got is straight out of the maritime and maritime. And the steamboat, New Jersey, and all that, when you go back and research it. And even the Snyde Act, which was land ownership through mortgages, through the Snyde Act case, was a straight admiralty case, and everybody thinks it was a land case on a mortgage on a property in Michigan. Had nothing to do with the water, right?
Right.
Well, insurance does.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance, anything with insurance on it, pet insurance, house insurance, life insurance, death insurance, medical insurance, you name it, anything with insurance is Admiralty Maritime jurisdiction.
Admiralty and Maritime are one and the same?
Well, not really. Maritime, Admiralty is the law by which it's applied, and Maritime is the modus of operation of which the Admiralty has cognizance of. Admiralty was really the Admiral. When the Admiral came over, he represented the King.
Right.
And that's why they called it Admiralty. And then when these colonies were formed, when the Admiral came over from the ship, he is the King. He had the power of everything on the King.
Mm-hmm.
And he could come in to the land and go 200 miles inland. He's still the Admiral. He still rules the colony.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can start to see where Admiralty and maritime jurisdiction under international law is what they are operating under the war powers.
And I fear we're going to see this for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
And especially as we go to globalism, that's still going to be the rule.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Most definitely, yes.
I mean,
it's all international.
Oh, it's, yeah. No,
and
without that.
Any international law has to be under maritime.
Okay.
No matter what. Going back to Pardesius, to the Romans, to England, it all emanated from Hammurabi, 4000 B.C.
And so we have come full circle.
Yes, we've come full circle, yes. And it was only through the Admiralty Maritime, because when you look at Title 28, in the very beginning, which nobody bothers to go in, all the prefaces in the very beginning of Title 28, it all says, stares you right in the face, this is an Admiralty document. Title 28 is straight Admiralty.
Oh, yeah.
When you get into Title 24, or I'm saying Title 26, that's all Admiralty. All revenue is Admiralty, Maritime. Now, when you get into Title 28, and you go to 2460 to 2465. When you read in there, one of the sections is 2465, it says it was, must be as near as Admiralty as can be.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because Admiralty has two sides to it. You have the criminal side, which is the Admiralty first instance prize and capture, who then, after you get into the Admiralty court, reverts to the civil side. And it'll tell you that right in the rules.
Okay.
And in fact, in the cases in the book that I had put in there, in the New History of America, you'll see I used the two cases, a Ford and a 1962 Chevrolet or something like that. There's two separate cases. And they tell you right in there that they were seized under Admiralty principles and then reverted to the civil side of Admiralty in the federal court.
Actually, you know, if people would check certain sections of what's called the classifieds,
right?
You will find, I guess, the seizures and such and auctions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The IRS always has to put it in there. Yeah,
yeah, and it's under Admiralty law. You're absolutely right.
Yep.
And you can, everybody can check their own daily newspapers. I mean, the bigger ones, will, you know, like the Tampa Tribune here, will definitely show that. And it's a hoot. Yeah, that's it's definitely mentioned.
Especially like, you know, you get the Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
The Charleston paper down in South Carolina mm-hmm. there. I mean, they're all port towns.
Yep.
So they have a much more of a chance of seeing it there. And any IRS that puts a seizure in it must be in Admiralty and satisfy all the procedures that must go through, even to the U.S. Marshals, because the U.S. Marshals are governed by Admiralty and Maritime. And that's why U.S. Marshals, when they seize a boat from a millionaire or something, they have to have a bond. And they're bonded under maritime principles to operate, to seize that ship under Admiralty law.
Yep. We can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't. You know,
it's amazing.
It's there for everybody to see, but most people are not educated enough to begin with to know this. Once you're educated and you start all of a sudden looking at all this stuff that's going around you, and she says, that's Admiralty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, hey, you know, the gold fringe flag is the admiral's flag, the commander-in-chief, and that's why, under military principles, you will always see a gold fringe flag in any courtroom.
Well, I'm going to bring it to an end.
It doesn't mean that it's a military court.
Right.
It is. Because it's controlled by the commander-in-chief. And all symbolism has been lost by the majority of the American people today.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've grown up with it. It's true.
Sure.
And we've not questioned it.
And it's just because of the education system that has been rammed down everybody's throat.
Yep.
And now you're getting judges and law clerks and attorneys who are just as dumbed down.
Yep.
As the average American is, to all these symbolisms and law and old-time history, because when I had the Clemson professor call me up when he was in England, and he says, now, what did you want? I said, I wanted the Treaty of Peace. That's all I want. If you can give me a certified copy of the Treaty from the library, the London Library, because only law professors can go in. Even if I could get over here, I couldn't go in. And he says, okay. When he came back, and he gave it to the fella that ended up giving it to me, because I couldn't make it down to South Carolina, to Clemson at the time, and he says, I couldn't believe it. The professor says, I couldn't believe that I saw a law from 545 A.D. that I know, in fact, exists today and is operating.
English Civil Code of Law.
Yeah, 545
yep.
A.D. It was drafted, and it is in operation today. He says, I couldn't believe what I saw in all these, of all these old laws that are operating today on the people.
And
he's a law professor.
Well, okay, then I have to ask you, I mean, when he came back or whenever he digested all this,
yep.
what was his presumption of the way things are?
He couldn't believe it. He says, man, he says, I've got to have to rethink a lot of my stances. And he says, what I'm teaching in school is wrong.
It's wrong. That's right. Well,
that's like the Admiralty book that I got from the law professor down there in University of Texas when he gave me Robertson.
Okay.
And he wrote the book on Admiralty and Federalism. And it's the history and analysis of the problems of federal-state relations in the maritime law of the United States. It was printed in 1970. I didn't get the autographed copy. The other fellow got the autographed copy. He gave me the copy that he didn't autograph. And he says that he was forbidden to publish this book anymore, and they took it out of the University of Textbook Series. It was a university textbook series especially designed for collateral reading by Harry Jones, professor of law, Columbia University. And this was made by the Foundation Press Incorporated in Mineola, New York, in 1970 of January. And I mean, it just goes out and it just lays it out so much as to how this country is operating and has operated under international maritime law, and that is one of the genesises that brought in, and it says, the framers of the Constitution intended to establish jurisdiction and not to prescribe particular codes or systems of law. Constitutional grant of judicial power in all cases our admiralty and maritime jurisdiction was no more intended to make the rules of maritime law binding upon the federal courts of common law than to make the rules of common law binding upon the courts of admiralty. It just, you know, that's a quote right out of the book on page 190.
So that book has been disappeared.
It's disappeared, yes. Me and about three other guys are the only ones that's got copies of it.
I tell you what, we're running a little bit over, but if there is something I wanted to ask you, if you're feeling up to it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have to go anywhere real fast right now.
Okay. Sounds like you're in the bathroom, but that's okay.
No.
Not
quite there.
No, all right. Well, you know, you did mention something before. And this is something that's probably I'm a little bit more attuned to since having moved down in the South.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm going to say, I don't want everybody to get all crazy and say, well, you know, you think slavery is good. No, I don't. However, there were some, tenets to which the Southern states adhered that I think made good sense. And I'll let you address that if you wish. And also, what an absolute screw job the Southern states got after being readmitted into the Union.
Oh, yeah.
Now, first of all, do you believe that for whatever, if we were doomed anyway to a certain extent, that at least the Southern states had it together as far as wanting to be kind of free of a central government?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because, remember, the Declaration of Independence is just that. It's a declaration. It's not law. It's not binding upon anybody. It's just what somebody declared. Just like Spooner says, he can go upon the Commons of Boston and declare whatever he wants, but that doesn't make it authoritative, it doesn't make it law. It's just those who want to believe what he says, believes what he says, and those who don't want to believe it, they don't have to believe it.
You were saying about?
Yeah, the gross national product of the South was three times the North.
All right, restate that. What was the gross national product of the South?
Three times.
As larger than the North?
Of the North. I don't have any particular thing. This is all off the top of my head, so
okay.
I'm trying to remember, and I think it was, if you put a number on it, it would be $3 million a month versus $1 million a month for the North.
All right, so prior to the Civil War, is this correct?
Yes, prior to the Civil War.
The South was kicking the North's butt economically.
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, the ports of Charleston, forget about New York and Philadelphia ports, Charleston and all the southern ports, Virginia, they had so much more trade from them. Because remember, the South had a lot of cotton, a lot of, you know, peanuts, a lot of whatnot.
They had all the raw materials.
They had all the raw materials, yeah. And the North, well, yeah, they had, you know, Jersey had a lot of farming, and Pennsylvania had a lot of cows, and and farming, but nothing like the South because the growing season was so much better.
Absolutely.
They were more industrialized in the North than sure. You know, mining and oil and stuff like this, although they did have some oil fields in North Carolina. Over towards the coast more.
Yeah, but oil doesn't become a real player until after the Civil War, even though they were aware of it. Yeah.
Right, right.
So,
but, you know, you're talking pine trees and stuff like this and forestry and all kinds of plants and like you're in Florida, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you got citrus fruits, right?
Right.
There's no citrus fruits up north.
Oh, no, not only that, but cotton was a big player, too.
Sure. That's what I say, cotton and before the boll weevil.
Okay, right.
And, but, yeah, they and the shipping and whatnot, and they had so much more over the north. That's why the banks of France and the Prussian Czar and everything, that's why they dealt with the south much more than they did the north.
Well, then let me ask you this, though, then, because you've stated that. So states' rights, was that really the issue, or was it a fact that the south as a block was doing so much better than the North?
Yeah, so it wasn't really, you know, states' rights or slavery or anything like that. I mean, even when you read Lincoln's papers, it wasn't over slavery. He could care less. He just wanted to control the South because of the money.
Now, was the South making noise prior to the Civil War? That, like, why were you even involved with these bozos?
Because, you know, the difference between the Bank of England fronted most of the money up north, while the Bank of France fronted most of the money in the south.
Oh, so this still is an extension of the European problems.
That's right. And this is what people don't realize, you know, they got to get in. There's researchers and there's researchers. Just like there's doctors and doctors and mechanics, you know. There's some roughshod mechanics and there's some guys that's bet your car's life on it, right?
But you know now, I mean, are you on board with the accounts that seem to be credible? I'm going to ask you that the Civil War was wreaking havoc to a certain extent with the economy in Europe. And the Brits had said, you know, you basically don't get this over with, we're going to come in.
Yeah.
Now, apparently they moved troops into Canada. On the other hand, the French moved troops into Mexico. Now, I don't know how nefarious that was. Some placed that at the hands of the Vatican, who had told Maximilian to get over there and do that. On the other hand, you look at France, as you're saying, that the Bank of France is backing the South. Then they have a little stake. So I don't know what, unless that's congruent. I mean, I don't know.
No, they have a lot of stake because, you see, the banks in France and everything, remember, Bank of England, let's just say the private bank in England has nothing to do with England, just a big conglomeration. Now, a lot of these conglomerations of the people on the board of the Bank of England own the Bank of France. So there's infighting in there between these people, the German Fruggers. The Bank of England would not allow the German Fruggers, they call them, to be a member of their bank. They would not allow any Jewish people to be a member of their bank, no matter whether it was Rothschild or not. They were not Jewish-oriented, and they weren't German Frugger-oriented.
Well, did the Rothschilds control the Bank of France?
To a great extent, yes.
But apparently they were independent enough that they could go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, you know, a bit against the Bank of England with the North.
Right, right. Now, a good movie to see, and I can't remember, it was made in 1929, Giles, and it was a whole story on the Rothschilds. And I saw it on TV once about 8 years ago.
Really?
I wished I could have remembered it, what the name of it was, but you know, it was a good story. But knowing what you know on history, and you looked at it, you got a totally different slant than the average person going to the movie theater, sitting down and watching it for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many things you pick up. Oh, that's why. Oh, that's, you know, it's just like boom, 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 right down the line.
Yeah, I don't mean to muddy the waters, but I will say this. There's an account where the Vatican and the Pope basically told Maximilian to get over there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because you've got to remember who fronted the Vatican in the war in the Crusades.
The Rothschilds.
That's right. So that's where the Vatican cabal with the Rothschilds, the bank, and them, really took over control of the British subjects in 1215 because everything was turned over to the Vatican under the spoils of war. So that the king could be re-communicated, and he was excommunicated, and his soul was never to go to heaven, according to them. And back in those days, you know, they believed everything the Vatican said, and therefore, that's why he turned all of his land and all of his subjects even over to the Vatican control. Then the Vatican turned around and gave him power back as a... like a proprietor, like he did over here in America, when he gave the seven proprietors control of all the land, and he took a quitrent tax instead of the ad valorem tax. That's how they were paid.
Well, you meant, well, you did say that the Rothschild staked the Vatican during the Civil War or around that time.
Yeah, yeah, and they staked the. A lot of them, they believe it or not, the bank, the Rothschilds, staked Germany and the United States and England. He had his hand in all three countries fighting each other.
Have you ever read the book by Burke McCarty in 1929, The Suppressed Truth About the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln?
No, I never read that.
Well, here's what's interesting. I mean, here's a book about the whole Vatican intrigues in the assassination of Lincoln, but it also says in kind of a forward kind of way, I mean, the forward to a book, a prologue, if you will,
right.
It says that the Roth, well, it says two things. One, it says that right now the Vaticans are in Japan, the Jesuits, I'm sorry, at the behest of the Vatican, are in Japan to instigate anti-American sentiment for a future war. And she writes this in 1929.
Right.
Another thing she stated was there was a time when the Rothschilds backed more or less financially the Vatican, but that has more than turned the other way around.
Right.
There was a time when they got a helping hand, but the Vatican certainly.
Well, that might be part of what I read in Manuel's book. although I didn't read that, but the particular book you're talking about, it did state as to why they told Stimson, who was
Secretary of War at the time,
told Rockefeller, told because he was tied in with Rockefeller too.
Right.
Told Roosevelt in 1933 when he first came in, Roosevelt wanted to fight Japan right then and there, and they said no, bide the time because this and this and this and happened, and the oil fields of your buddy Rockefeller in
China, right?
They're being attacked, and this is why when they do that, now you can institute the war. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
In 1933, he wanted to start the war.
Well, who, Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that he didn't want to do anything, but he was instigated to do such.
Right.
Probably by the Rockefellers. And I tell you what, Smedley Butler said the same thing.
Yeah.
Butler, you know, obviously in War in Iraq, had talked about making the oil fields safe in China for the Rockefellers.
Right.
And they got freaked out when Japan went nuts.
Yeah,
because they thought they would overtake that. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, would you agree that really presidents don't initiate anything? They are basically the executor of other plans.
Yeah, all he is the front man.
Yeah, and I mean, he, you know, to this day, I mean, he probably looms as the most, as the president, well, I think, with the most impact on American life and history.
Right.
All that took place. And are you also, I mean... I don't want to give you too much longer, but now we're hitting all these things, and I've not had a chance to talk to you in so long. Are you familiar with a book that was written by William Z. Foster, I guess, second in command for the American Communist Party, back in 1932, called Toward Soviet America?
I read bits and pieces. I never read the whole book. No.
Okay, because I know they have been posted on the web, and I'm going to assume that's where you probably read some of it.
No, I read it in a hard copy when I was visiting somebody. Yeah, he had a hard copy of that book.
All right, so you at least had it in your hands and you went through it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's another thing that I think...
I just briefed through it.
Okay.
I was only there for about 4 hours, and I had an hour just to look at it. You know?
Oh, no, I got it. I mean, you will find parts of it, excerpts, on the web. So, but I mean, I understand you had a lucky dip and go as you had, you know, with the time you had.
I had a hard copy in my hand, yeah.
Well, you know, here's another thing that I try to... You know, show people, you know, if they're not going to buy conspiracy, because conspiracy is real, it's just secret.
Yeah.
One of the things I try to say to them is, well, why don't you go back and read some of these accounts of people who said this is the way it's going to be, and then it came true.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Well, Foster and 32, actually, I mean, to me, it seemed like a little laughingly, that he wrote, folks, this is what's going to happen in the United States. You're going to get federalized, and basically you guys call it federalized, but it's Sovietized.
Yeah.
Now, he said this in 32. Now, we understand the Depression had an impact. We understand that the war did. But what I'm saying is, and as we will see again in our history very shortly, you make these events happen as a cause for a certain effect.
Right.
So, yes, the stock market crash was definitely manipulated.
Yes.
And so were the wars.
Yeah, because, see, we never went bankrupt because the little section that I put on there, I actually had the Geneva books that everybody was claiming that they couldn't get. Well, they're there. I got them. I got them from another fella.
Really?
I had them for about a month. And then I had to give them back. And if they go on there, they'll read the Geneva books and excerpts from it. And you'll see that we were in no way were we bankrupt. And in fact, Firestone was instrumental in bailing out the United States debt to two countries. He actually paid the debt.
Jeez. So Firestone did this?
Yes. And it even goes in and it shows how the IRS was operating in every country, proving that it's private, foreign.
So the IRS, in fact, is what they say it is, and that is a collection agency for the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England.
Because the exchequer is the same as the Bank of England, is the same as the Federal Reserve here. They're all one happy family.
Okay.
So if the people of this country could look at every state and the United States as nothing but a corporation, a private corporation operating outside the constitutional parameters, which in no constitutional parameter can be bought in a private sector law for any defense whatsoever.
All right.
In fact, private law supersedes any constitutional law.
Yeah, it's always been about business.
Yes. And yours right back to your maritime, admiralty, international law.
Now, the information that we've been getting, since I'll never be in that situation, and never have been, about having a child birthed in a hospital, is it true what they say about the child being issued an SS number right there?
Yeah, they can issue an SS number, but I've known people that has dropped that, and they took it off. One was up in Pennsylvania. I can't think of the name of the case right now. But he got it removed.
For a short time.
Until she became 18 or whatever it was, and then...
You're back into it.
Yeah.
All right, so at least they're issuing him, from birth, and of course you can get, I guess, some cessation for about 18 years, and then you're back into it.
Right, right.
And so most people aren't going to go ahead and fight that, are they?
No. No.
And that whole bit about capital letters and the birth certificate and everything else is true, that you are the corporate entity known as John Smith?
Well...
Or is that something different there?
The capitalization does have a bearing on it, yes. But whether the birth certificate, because I went back into a lot of the laws and back in the 20s when the maternity laws came into effect and all that, and I'm still out in, I still reserve some judgment on that. But the birth certificate, some people get really carried away with it and they go off. So deep on there that you look at it and you just laugh.
And what you're referring to also is a lot of the legends that have been promulgated by the Patriot community.
Right, right. Yeah, a lot of the legends are being promulgated by Patriots back in the 30s and 40s and even before the people today were born. And, I was lucky to have some parents that, died in the 90s that... gave me some good stuff and good information all the way back, how bad Roosevelt was. I mean, they hated his guts. and everybody's saying, oh, how wonderful he was, and Mom and Dad hated him, they weren't really patriots. They were just educated people.
Sensible.
And, didn't believe everything the government told them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's what brought me up in that line of thinking. And even when I first got my job in 1955, I got out of school and I got a job and I had to give a Social Security. And I didn't know at the time, so I went down, I got a social security number, and then I was complaining because when I saw them taking the money out of my check, the first check, I said, why the heck do I have to do this? You know, I shouldn't have to pay for this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, wasn't that whole idea of the Social Security supposed to be a Band-Aid for a particular time, and then it was supposed to be vacated?
Yeah, that was actually, Roosevelt instituted that only for federal old age assistance. It wasn't for it to be in the states, but they wangled it around so they could get it in the states and tout it as insurance when it wasn't, because Altmaier, who is the instigator of that, I've got his congressional hearings in 1953 where he comes out and said that was a fraud, that was wrong, they issued the wrong stuff, and it wasn't insurance, and it wasn't this, and I think that's on ATG Press, too.
Mm.
If not, it's in the book, which the New History of America, and it gives excerpts from it. I've got the whole thing here, but yeah, it goes out and tells you. He goes right out and says, "Oh, it was only for civil service."
Okay.
Which meant government workers.
Once again. Okay.
Yeah. They lumped everything in because Congress, under the War Powers Act, says we can do this, and they passed it and forced every state to use it, and that's why they call it, oh, well, it's state, it's not federal. Well, bull. It's all federal.
You know, I could keep you forever, and you sound like you're loaded for bear, and you probably could stay on, but I can't do that.
I could stay on for 12 hours more and talk till I was forced.
Well, I'll tell you what, they're going to ask for you to come back on again, and I can't blame them because I want you to, but I would have to say this, if we could end this on a certain note.
Okay.
And I mean, you believe in Jesus Christ, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So you understand that the war is never lost.
No.
Whatever happens on this earth happens, but it passes away, and eternity is eternity.
Yeah.
So, having said that, not being of a pessimistic mind, I have to think of that Sinatra song, I guess, what we know it best with him, when he says, send in the clowns, don't bother, they're here.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would associate that with, don't worry about martial law,
right.
It's already here.
Oh, yeah, it's here.
And the fix has been in for some time.
Yeah. Well, it's really what not you call martial law, because the terminology is different.
Yeah, right. Okay, great.
Military control without martial law.
Mm-hmm.
There is fine lines of distinction in there, and we're not under martial law yet, because under military law, that's what we're under, they allow the civilian population to go as they are going, but they are being controlled by unseen forces as to what to do. It's when martial law comes into effect, they actually have uniformed officers in those positions handling it.
And I would assume, too, that that's when you're living life at the point of a bayonet.
Right.
But for now, at least administratively, governmentally...
military law.
Okay.
Military rule.
Okay.
It's not martial law.
It's rule.
Military rule.
All right, listen, thank you for being with us, and just stay with us right there. And folks, you've been listening to The I Man. Please go to ATGPress.com. Check it out. He's done all this work, as James Montgomery has, and a lot. It's probably the greatest little nugget that nobody knows about. With respect to all that's going on, go there. It's common sense. And thanks for listening to the show, folks. We'll see you later.
All right. You've been listening to The I Man. That was the second part of a two-part segment we did last week. And I think he may have misspoken. He sent me an email again last week. And I think he wanted to say that you don't have the bankers. The bankers have you. It's the other way around than what he just spoke about early in the show. Also, in reference to that letter by Mercier, if you want that, just send me an email, and I'll send it to you as a Word doc attachment if you want to read it. It's about 6.5 pages. So if you want to look at that correspondence, I can send it to you. I looked on his website. I didn't see where that was. I'm assuming it's not there. So that's why, again, if you want it, just give me an email and we'll get that done. Again, tomorrow we're going to have on Bob Chapman. And on Monday we're going to have on Jay Beldo. And we'll take it from there. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow. We'll be right back.
Okay.